Tonight on Arena, we host a special Dublin Theatre Festival preview show with Mark O'Connell, Marina Carr, Emmett Kerwin, Louise Lowe, Deirdre Kinahan and more. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Yes, it's that time of year again for theatre lovers all over Ireland. In spite of COVID-19 and the restrictions involved there, the Dublin Theatre Festival has put together an exciting programme of plays and events. Tonight we hope to bring you a flavour of the programme with interviews, extracts and performances involved along the way. And yes, there will be people sitting in theatres looking at actors standing up on stage. That's an exciting development in and of itself. This year's festival begins on Thursday of next week and will run through until October the 11th. The question of whether a future through which we can upload our minds to a computer server and become part of what some people call the singularity is the subject of Mark O'Connell's 2017 Rooney Prize winning work of non-fiction, To Be a Machine. Now, as part of the 2020 Dublin Theatre Festival, the theatre company Dead Centre is collaborating with Mark to produce a live-streamed stage show adaptation of the book starring Jack Gleeson. With me in studio, in reality, is Mark O'Connell, and joining us virtually down the line, as it were, is Bush McCarzel of Dead Centre. The audience members will be invited to upload themselves onto 110 screens that will be in the theatre space in the Project Arts Centre for each of the live performances. It's an extraordinary task to do that, and I'll come to Bush McCarthy about the specifics of that in a moment, maybe. But first of all, to yourself, Mark, just remind us of the book and what you were writing about in To Be a Machine. Transhumanism is everywhere in the book and indeed in the play.
Yeah, so, I mean, the book, as you say, came out in 2017, so it's a while now in my life since I was involved in this world. But the book essentially is an examination of a social movement known as transhumanism, which is basically predicated on the idea that the future of the human species, our next sort of stage of evolution, involves a merger with technology, sort of taking technology into our own bodies to improve the sort of basic functionality of the human body and the human mind, and ultimately uploading our minds into machines, becoming ourselves machines. That's the kind of premise of the thing.
Yeah, but the big bogeyman, if it is a bogeyman here, is this is about, or a large part of it seems to be about, cheating death.
Yeah, I mean that's really what drew me to this kind of milieu in the first place, is that really what this is about. Although, you know, we're talking about, in a lot of ways, very radical, very extreme, very sort of futuristic sci-fi ideas, really what it's about is, you know, the oldest story in the book, the oldest story we have, which is, you know, our sort of immemorial desire to outrun our own mortality. So, you know, it's as much to do with religion or the kind of yearnings and desires that come out of religion as it is to do with any kind of, you know, future technology.
I remember at the time of the winning of the Rooney Prize, I was talking about it just before we came to where you were actually, you had just heard that you'd won it. There was a big party.
That's when I was hustled down to a room to talk to you, yeah.
Yeah, I remember, and so it was literally in that very moment. And I said to you at that time that it was the first time that a work of non-fiction had won the Rooney Prise. I'm wondering, I'll go to you on this one, Bush McCarzel. I'm sure you've done works of non-fiction before, but to decide to adapt this work of non-fiction for the stage, how did that come about? I know yourself and Mark are long-time friends.
Yes, well, I think it's because it's a work of fiction in disguise in a lot of ways. You have Mark as the narrator protagonist in the book and going on a journey and coming out the other side having, you know, learned something about himself after through all these encounters. So I think the fictional dramatic journey was latent, and we just wanted to bring it to the surface.
Yeah. So as far as you were concerned, there was a big fictional element in there that you thought you could put on the stage.
There was a voice. That was the main thing. You know, Mark's writing has just got such a great voice, such great humor, and that's when you can hear the way the information is being put across, you can hear a character immediately. Yeah.
I mentioned in the introduction there about 110 screens will be in the theatre space in the Project Theatre. I just love this aspect of things. We can't get 110 people into the space because social distancing, all kinds of rules will be broken. So explain what you're doing there, which is very much at the heart of what the book is talking about anyway.
Well, that was the idea that we, you know, we wanted to turn, I think the term is crisis-tunity, where you take a crisis into an opportunity. And the context of you know, the global pandemic is a way of, has reframed our bodies as biohazards. And suddenly it's sort of our embodied natures which are framed and seen as a problem. Mm. And we wanted to see that idea plays into the hands of transhumanism. So when, of course, theater can't operate in its usual way of bringing people together, we wanted to take that problem and see if it could complement the story of transhumanism and how we would tell the story. So, as you mentioned, we are uploading our audience into 110 screens. Poor old Jack Gleason was going to have a strange experience as an actor, be acting to a room of screens. But, you know, it's to sort of investigate the what's lost and what kind of connection can still happen through screens.
Yeah, not only is he acting to a room of screens, but he will be interacting with that room of screens right. as well. So people will be live at home on their whatever device.
They'll be live at home. Exactly, live streaming from their computers, presumably, or maybe TVs if they have an internet TV. But we will give them a simulated presence right. in the room. So there will be a way in which Jack can see the face of the audience, and then, of course, the audience can see his face. So you're trying to simulate a version of the in-the-room experience. Yeah. But, through this digital.
In the development stages then of this, Mark O'Connell, who wrote the original book, at what point did that idea come up that the audience would be like that, and how excited were you about this idea? Because it really does, it touches on the very philosophies that are being examined in the book.
Yeah, I mean, it was quite late in the day, because obviously we were talking about this initially as a, you know, a straightforward, well, not straightforward, but, you know, as a stage play. And then the pandemic happened and the lockdown happened and, you know, such things were no longer conceivable. It was certainly after the lockdown happened and, you know, we were talking about ways in which it might be possible to do some version of this show. And Bush at a certain point came, he texted me at one point and said, you know, I feel like this should be a play within an audience. And, you know, I was kind of intrigued, but, you know, I didn't necessarily think it would be doable or go anywhere. And of course it isn't a play without an audience, but in a way it is.
A play with a virtual audience.
Yeah. And I mean it just sort of speaks very beautifully to a lot of the themes in the book, as well as the themes of our time.
In the book, what you did essentially was it was a series of interviews. You spoke to a lot of people who are interested in transhumanism, and many of whom would have enough money to pursue the ideas of transhumanism. Who was the guy from Google? I know you didn't get to speak to him directly, but he's all over the book and he's a very important aspect of the book.
Yeah, that's Ray Kurzweil, who you know, is an inventor of some note before he became known as this sort of high priest of transhumanism. But he is a director of engineering at Google. And he's a sort of progenitor, or at least popularizer, of this idea of the singularity, which is this notion, almost kind of a religious notion, that at some point in the future, the development of technology, specifically artificial intelligence, is going to become so powerful and so sophisticated that it will be possible for us to literally extract our consciousnesses, our individual minds, and upload them to machines. So this is the idea of the singularity, which in a way the play sort of takes as its
This is the cyborg in Star Trek Next Generation, isn't it?
I guess so.
Resistance is futile. You're part of the collective, and the collective will always be the thing that will win through. Individuals aren't important anymore.
Yes, yeah. Well, I mean, the thing for me that's so fascinating about it is that it's predicated on a very extreme form of individualism, this idea that, you know, the self is the most important thing and the self must not die. The worst possible imaginable thing is the death of oneself. And yet it's such an extreme form of individualism that it pushes through that in a way and sort of obliterates the very idea of the individual.
But you did get, you actually met with groups of people who are firm believers and absolute, you know, total belief in the idea that transhumanism, which may involve in some cases decapitation, that transhumanism can lead to a situation where you can be effectively brought back to life. What sort of people did you meet? Because on the surface of it, you think, these people are half mad. But I think you went in with a much more open mind than I would have gone in with.
Yeah, I mean, they are half mad, but they're half mad in ways that reflect the ways in which we're all a bit half mad.
Yeah, they're half sane as well.
Yeah, and the ways in which our culture is certainly at least half mad. So yeah, you know, I was open-minded about it. I was never convinced, or at least converted. There were moments where I sort of was brought sort of over the line into transhumanism or some kind of, adoption of maybe some of their premises. But by and large, I'm skeptical of the whole thing. But I think what's interesting about this show is that, Bush and Ben are bringing a different kind of sensibility to it. And my skepticism is sort of is tempered by something a little bit more provocative, I think, in the show, a little bit more, I guess, not to say that it adopts the standpoint of transhumanism, but it does something quite different to what the book does, I think.
I guess the reality is you could argue, Bush, that theatre has been transhumanistic for years now, in that actors upload characters into their bodies,
I think so. There's a crossover there in the fact that transhumanism is basically investigating the idea of identity and saying you're not the way you view yourself is not the whole story. And of course, theater sort of begins, the naive premise is somebody walks out onto the stage and says, "Hello, my name is X," and you know they're not that person.
Yeah.
So we always play this sort of double game. And so, yeah, identity has always been at the heart of what theatre is exploring.
Yeah.
So there's something that they're harmonising there a little bit.
And I guess even though this fits in directly with the book, theatre makers are going to have to continue to be very adaptive in what and how they present pieces in the coming months and years, I would guess. Bush, would you agree?
Well, it seems to be that. I mean, after this pandemic, there won't be a major theatre in the world that isn't doubling down on their digital department after this. And, every play will be, or the digital dimension of it will be considered now.
And doing it in alliteration, doubling down on the digital department. I like that. Listen, that's Bush McCarzel there, who's directing the piece that we've been speaking about, that piece being the theatrical adaptation of Mark O'Connell's book, To Be a Machine. Mark was with me in studio this evening. To Be a Machine, which they have laughed with a little bit of humour, called Version 1.0. There may be sequels. It stars Jack Gleeson. It will be streamed live from the Project Arts Centre from October the 1st as part of the 2020 Dublin Theatre Festival. And as with everything we'll be speaking about this evening, you will find out full details on dublintheatrefestival.ie. The festival is also offering audiences a chance to see Irish National Opera's Least Like the Other, Searching for Rosemary Kennedy. This is a work composed by Brian Irvine. It tells the shocking untold story of the eldest daughter of Rose and Joe Kennedy, Rosemary, who suffered from mental health issues. In the piece from this section that we're about to hear from the opera, Naomi Louise O'Connell performs the Vineland Lecture, and this particular lecture highlights some of the frightening attitudes to mental health in the 1950s.
Dr. Martin Barr has been counselling us for nearly half a century.
There we go. The Vineland Lecture, as performed by Naomi Louise O'Connell from Least Like the Other, Searching for Rosemary Kennedy. That's the opera that can be seen at the O'Reilly Theatre on Saturday, September the 26th, as part of this year's Dublin Theatre Festival. Also amongst the offerings is a series of plays entitled Theatre for One, originally seen during Cork Midsummer Festival last year and now to be staged in the foyer of the Abbey Theatre in Dublin in a special performance booth where one audience member at a time will enjoy a one-on-one experience with an actor in a time period of no more than 5 minutes. There are six plays in total, commissioned by Landmark Productions and Octopus Theatricals. And in the six, we have some of our leading playwrights, Marina Carr, Emmett Kerwin, Louise Lowe, Marco Rowe and Enda Walsh. With me in studio this evening is Marina Carr and Emmett Kerwin. It joins us on the line. When I heard Theatre for One originally, I thought, oh, this is classic now, a way of dealing with the problems that we have. It's one person on stage, so there'll be no worries about interaction. But it brings it a step further with just one audience member as well, Marina.
Yeah, it does. And, you know, the fact that this has been around for a while, it just seems everything is a monologue now and everything is one, you know, one for however many. But it is a very intimate experience, as we realised last year when it was done in Cork. And it's quite an extraordinary thing. You're very close to the performer. There's nothing between... Well, there's a Perspex screen now because of COVID regulations. But that aside, it seems to be... It's just for you. And I saw a few of them. And it is, you know, as an audience member, you have to give a fair bit, you know? There's eye contact and there's proximity and... That, you know, you can't be on your phone and you can't be sneezing and, you know.
Surely you wouldn't be on your phone in a big theatre anyway.
Well, it's surprising how hard it is for a lot of people to settle down in a theatre, you know.
Yeah.
You know, with the chocolates and the crisps and the phone and the, you know, where will I cough? You know, I'll wait for the great soliloquy and have a good old sneeze in competition. So you get a bit of that. So there's none of that. There's no escape. Mm. But having said that, I found it really kind of enchanting in a way, you know, to be that close and for it to be just for me. I'm talking about seeing the others.
Yeah. What about from the writing side of things, though? Did it, when you knew, because obviously it was conceived then as this Theatre for One idea, that it was also one in the audience as well as one on stage or in the booth with the other audience member. Did it affect the piece that you wrote? Did it affect the piece that you chose, in fact, that might be used for this?
Well, it's obviously for one, so that narrows it down, the time thing then. So it has to be kind of a nugget. Hmm. It has to be kind of... you know, around one metaphor, one image, really, for it to fly. So it wasn't difficult because I think, you know, particularly playwrights, usually you're thinking in the long stretch, you're thinking the two act or the three act or maybe the one long act.
Yeah.
And sometimes a lot of what you're writing is filler. So it's kind of nice in a way, you know, to just give it to me in 5 minutes and that's it. And
no
give it
longer.
To me, yeah, with one actor. So that's kind of, that can be exhilarating.
Signum Canticum is the name of your piece. Did it pre-exist, all of this, or was it written especially for this?
It was written, well, the image was there a long time, but the this piece was written particularly for Landmark and Octopus and for this format. But the image itself, which centres around the alighting of a flock of swans on a lake to bid goodbye to a dead woman. So that image has been in my mind a long time. And swans, as you know, are huge in Irish mythology. I think every child, you know, the wild swans of Cool, we all, that's gone into our DNA at this point.
Yeah, the children of Lir.
And the children of, they would be the two seminal ones, I think every Irish person would, if they don't know all the details at least, or can't quote it, they would know the bones of these, this story and the poem.
And the specifics of this piece, the image of this group of swans basically gathering to see off this woman, mother who dies young. Was it just a purely imagined thing, or where did it come from? Or where do these things come from?
Yeah, it's all true. It's all made up. Well, I suppose to come clean, this actually happened. I mean, but can you ever say that as a writer? Because you're making it up as well. But that actually did happen. As my mother was removed from the house, we grew up in front of a lake. These swans suddenly appeared in the dusk, and they just lined up on the lake. Massive amount. I mean, you could. What do they call it? Is it a wedge of swans when they're flying? But I don't know. A flock, a massive flock, and there they were, just in rows on the lake, and it was that terrible winter where there was ice and snow. And it had begun.
And was your mother? It's a young mother in the script. Was she a young woman?
She was a young woman. Yeah, she was early 40s when she died. And there they all were, and we all clocked it, and all the neighbours, and it was a huge funeral because, you know, when someone dies young and leaves children and all of that, it's a big thing. So the whole parish was there, and I think everybody clocked, but nobody spoke about it. But it was just one of those kind of magical things that happened. And there they were, and then she was put into the hearse, and we all headed off to the church, and the swans were there, and when we came back, they were gone.
And am I right in thinking that that lake, in when you were growing up, obviously was near to your home, there were generally two swans there, or certainly there wasn't a flock of whatever
there. There were two. There were
and
two.
That was it.
Yeah, and they would have cygnets, and they'd beat them off the lake every summer, or at the end of every summer, because there wasn't enough food on the lake to feed them. It was a small lake. And this was always kind of, we would watch this kind of in horror and fascination, you know, the cob and the pen beating off the children, and literally, and the cygnets would be trying to come back. You know,
encouraging them out of home, perhaps.
That's it. Off you go, seek your fortune, off to university with you or whatever. But and we would watch this, and it was a thing that my mother would watch, you know, that connection. So that the image was there.
It's extraordinary that it has that basis in reality. But I love the idea, because as I read it, I couldn't help but see you, or, you know, because it's a first person narrative. But it's Sean McGinley who is actually playing the part. Did you have a hand in that, you know, to I suppose, move it a step away from the autobiographical by having the male actor perform?
I think that does help. But also, Sean is an extraordinary actor. I love his voice, and I love what he does with language. Because what you want is someone who'll carry the power of what you're trying to say without putting too much on it. And Sean's master of that. And yes, I think switching the gender always helps as well. The little bit of distance, you know.
It helps a little bit.
Yeah.
A smart bit of gender swapping, perhaps, in your case too, Emmett Kerwin, in the case of Queen of the Pyramids. Just maybe give us the premise of your piece to start out, Emmett.
Well, it's kind of based on experiences I've had with people trying to sign me up for things called multi-level marketing, which is effectively a type of pyramid scheme, but it's technically illegal because there's products that are sold. And I a few kind of conversations with people, they'd spark up conversations with you in public or in an airport, or they would try and get your attention by asking, you know, what book are you reading, and then gain your confidence. And then after a few minutes, they might whip out a folder and say, would you like to, you know, be part of the wonderful world of this particular snake oil or whatever it was they were selling, you know. And so I kind of just thought about the idea of, because Theatre for One was the intimate, you know, one-on-one, and the idea of active listening as an audience member, you can't escape once you step into the photo booth or this theatre booth, I should say, which looks like a beautiful photo booth, beautifully designed one. What would happen if you were stuck with a person like this? But that part of the plot isn't actually revealed until later on. Mm. So when you first step in, the brilliant Kate Gilmore just has a black eye, and the story kind of unfolds. But yeah, it's based on MLM, which is a whole world. If you do a deep dive on it on the internet, it's pretty crazy.
And that aspect then that Marina has touched on in terms of the actual performance itself, the intimacy of the one-on-one experience, you kind of take that intimacy to the level of the trappedness of the one-on-one experience. Was that important?
Kind of was, yeah. I would feel the same way Marina does, you know, like crisp packets and as an actor as well, you know, like people smuggling like mints in and opening them up slowly, you know, in a theatre. It's like you imagine them out in the audience, but with this, it's kind of, I was thinking of it earlier, it's kind of like, you know, kinetoscope, but you can, it's the aperture is as wide as the stage, so that both people, the audience member and the actor, can see each other fully, and, you know, the fourth wall is completely gone, or now it's a perspex wall. And so it exists, the piece of theatre exists and can only exist if there is an audience member there, you know, because it's being delivered to them. They're never kind of just delivering a monologue to an empty space as if there is nobody there, you know.
And that live aspect of it, I mean, even These were all written pre-COVID or mid-COVID? Was it for you pre-COVID?
Oh, yeah, last year.
So it was last year at Cork Midsummer. So there was no mention of the idea. But somehow it fits in, Emmett, to the situation we find ourselves in right now. Yes, as Marina said, the Perspex screen has to be there. But apart from that, it's perfect for our current situation regarding theatre.
Yeah, I suppose the lack of... or the need for people to connect with each other, you know, has been reduced down to laptops and mobiles. You know, it was a problem beforehand, but, you know, theatre as a communal thing to come together is lost, you know. So I think it's brilliant that something like this can happen, and even these things can happen virtually, because there is a sense of community, you know. And these MLM people as well, they get into it as well because they want to be part of a community of people, you know. There's a whole... positivity thing that they do with it, like where they have, you know, weekly meetups and stuff like that. So the loss of community, the loss of coming together, I suppose, as a group is something that's, you know, is felt by everybody in this time, you know.
But my understanding is that all six pieces will be performed in the booths. I presume you can go from one to the other in some order if you want to do it on the day, or go to one or two or three,
yeah,
Marina.
They're doing blocks of 3 hours. They're performing for 9 hours each day for 2 weeks. And so they'll do, I think, in threes. So you can see three. So you see, you see one, you come out, you queue up again, you see number two, you come out, queue up again, see number three. And I think there's some ticketing system they have. Yeah.
You get stamps as well, I think, if you're a completist.
Yeah, oh, really?
Yeah, you know.
Endurance test.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like a theatre burrito card, you know, or a coffee card. You get it stamped for everyone you've seen.
So what's the prize, Emmett?
Yeah, no, yeah. It's like the schoolyard at your stick.
10-hour monologue.
Yeah. Is it then, briefly and finally, Emmett, is it kind of a way then for the playwright now, for you and both you and Marina, to get back a little bit at people who rustle the papers and keep the phone on to do the likes? This one-on-one aspect.
I play completely for revenge. There's only two reasons to do that: love and revenge. And it's for those people that slowly opened Murray Mints while I was doing my soliloquy in whatever theatre.
So it's dedicated to them.
Dedicated to them and the theatre lovers as well, the people that enjoy.
Well, listen, it is great that we are having live events like this as part of the Theatre Fest, because it means a tough year in that respect for sure, Marina.
It's terrible.
Projects cancelled all over the place.
Left, so we're all in the same boat. There's no point in complaining, but it is a huge loss.
Yeah, for sure. Well, this isn't a loss, and people can go and see it and get their burrito stamps, as Emmett says. Theatre for One, produced by Landmark Productions and Octopus Theatrical, runs from September the 20th through until October the 11th as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival. And as we discussed, around 5 minutes long, each of the performances run from 11 a.m. all the way through until 10 p.m. most days. That's extraordinary for the actors involved. The performances are free, by the way, but you must have booked your tickets in advance. So that's well worth checking out, happening in the foyer of the Abbey Theatre. Festival begins, as we've been saying, Thursday, September the 24th. You'll find full details of this event and everything else happening on dublintheatrefestival.ie. And welcome back to Wednesday Night's Arena. We are talking about the Dublin Theatre Festival this evening and the excitement that there is around the fact that we do have live performances happening as part of the festival, for sure. Anu Theatre Company's contribution to this year's festival and to previous festivals has always elicited a sense of excitement. Last year, The Lost O'Casey was no exception. And this year, the Anu show is called The Party to End All Parties. Louise Lowe, the artistic director and founder of Anu, and writer and director of The Party to End All Parties. And the party in question is joining me on the line shortly, by the way. The party in question here was the declaration of the Irish Republic in 1949. Let's listen to how that happened.
"408 years after Henry VIII was crowned the King of Ireland, ERA cuts its last link with Britain. President Seán O'Kelly, the new state's first leader, joins a dense crowd in Dublin's O'Connell Street as the flag of ERA is hoisted on the GPO building. Here, as the veterans of the 1916 rebellion still recall, was the headquarters of the Sinn Féin Rising. And here, 33 years later to the day, the new ERA officially becomes an independent republic. There follows the biggest military review Dublin has seen for years. Units of the Republican Army parade past President O'Kelly. So comes into being the world's youngest republic. Although out of the Commonwealth, ERA's many common interests with Britain will still keep the two nations close partners in the years to come.
There you go. That's how Pathé News told the world about ERA and the formation, the official announcement on the party in 1949. Louise Lowe of Anu Theatre Company joining me on the line this evening. It's an amazing clip, that, isn't it, Louise?
Isn't it? Yeah, absolutely. I've listened to it a few times now and it still strikes me as like it's sounding like a place I don't know at all. Like it feels very far removed from any Dublin that we might know now.
Well, I guess that's possibly what you're doing in this performance from Anu. It's getting to the Dublin that did. We heard the fireworks in the background in the midst of that clip. What was that big party in 1949 and what aspect of it are you looking at? I would guess you're looking at it from a real Dubliner's point of view.
Well, we hope to, I suppose. There was a photograph that sat on our virtual desks now for probably the last 3 or 4 years, which was a photograph of O'Connell Bridge thronged with spectators on that night. And I had this fantasy in my head for the longest time that I'd love to make a piece of work about the night that Ireland became a republic and had been chatting to our company members, Matt and Lynette and Owen, about the possibility of doing that for a few years now, for some time. And this year we had planned a very different year, like most companies, and Dublin Theatre Festival came to us and said, we'd like to commission you to make something. But we'd like to commission you to make something that is live, that has elements of live performance, that does what you do. And we kind of got thinking about, well, you know, what can we do and what can we say? And I suppose this photograph came back into our being and we're like going, I can't imagine Dublin like that now. I can't imagine a moment where we would throng those streets or the bridge in that way. And I think yet in loads of ways, it's a moment to take stock and think about nationhood and republic and what being Irish is and what being a Dubliner is. Exactly. And then we kind of went off and went into like tangents and different spisms of thinking about what could we make that feels real? And what could we imagine that we'd like to make about a Dublin that feels removed and yet present and allows time to skip and time to join us again and to really push ourselves back onto the streets in a way that makes us feel vital and relevant.
So where are we, again, in the case of Anu's productions, it's often where we're seeing the piece of theatre that happens is as important as what we're seeing, or certainly it's a very important aspect of it.
Absolutely.
Where will we be looking at the party to end all parties?
Well, you'll start looking at it from the Irish Architecture Foundation. We are building a brand new company inside that building called Ballast, which is about future-proofing the city, a kind of a place-making initiative, a place where future cities are imagined and are born from. And that's not in the Irish Architecture Foundation currently. We are creating that inside that space, but inviting people into that building, which gives us a great vantage point out onto the Liffey and onto the city and out onto O'Connell Bridge itself. And from there, you will be invited to follow one track or another and to engage with three performers on that track in which they talk about themselves being on the edge of the city in the now and on a precipice for great change and looking for a catalyst or a motivation. And then they bring you journeying back towards O'Connell Bridge for a very intimate experience with them. I say intimate, but socially distanced experience with them and a communion with them that allows the audience in their own way to become the dramaturgs of their own experience in that place and position by helping the performer work out what might happen next for them.
And indeed yourself. Yeah. And is there an aspect of it then that refers back to the 1949 party to end all parties?
Absolutely. Yes, there is. And if that's witnessed from the windows. In which we look at creating a very full soundscape of what was then that is punctured by moments of time in which we have seen the bridge being used for celebration, for revolution, for riot, for change and for hope. And the Dublin Theatre Festival came to us and said, we'd like you to make something that is thinking about hope, and hope being central as we spin between the then and the now, and a need to create, reconnect now, I suppose, as palpable as we listen closely to each other and the city in the then as much as it is in the today. So I think it's skipping through time from 1949 into the Dublin of today, and you know, the city itself playing out as the mise-en-scène, and the background against the performances that you'll engage with as you go. And you know, we couldn't have made a piece of work about Dublin without thinking about James Joyce. So in lots of ways, it's playing homage to him, to things he said about the city, to pieces and places that he wrote, like Finnegan's Wake, and looking at the four episodes and in different ways, looking to be looking to echo, I suppose, parts of that time as well. And also allowing the Liffey to play a very prominent and visceral part of the show.
And just as we finish up, you're looking, you talked about several times there, and I suppose Finnegan's Wake time is a whole time of its own. But we are looking at the past, we're looking at the present, and this ballast thing that you've been speaking about is looking at the future as well. We have Dublin Meantime. Just explain what that was.
Dublin Meantime was Dublin's own time, which was 25 minutes and 21 seconds ahead of GMT. And the ballast ball was on top of Ballast House, which in O'Connell Bridge now, when we look, is still Ballast House. And above a Londa shop at the very, very top, there's a beautiful stone balcony that I think was reproduced at some point in the last number of years. But it looks almost identical. And Ballast House was responsible for keeping time. Dublin Port ends at O'Connell Bridge. Wow. And the ballast ball dropped every day at 12:35 Dublin time to tell the port and to tell the docks that it was 1 p.m. GMT time. So I suppose this idea of Dublin time, of us seeing the light first, of being having this our own time and lost time of these 25 minutes and 21 seconds that the show lasts for and then is doubled in your own time, really does have a great impact on what we think is kept and what is stored and what is hope and what is useful for us to engage with. So I suppose the performers inside it do ask us to think about Dublin Meantime and to reclaim it or to embrace that lost 25 minutes and 21 seconds. And I suppose within that then there's an invitation, because you know there's a reference about, you know, do you know what Joyce said was the most looked at thing in the city, and then talking about time and just saying, you know, is it up there, is it there for us to store when we need it, for when it matters, because it really matters now.
And so
I think that's really where we're basing all of the piece around.
Yeah, two audience members will be involved in the case of this particular production, and you have three performers who will take the audience then, are the two members split away from each other?
They are indeed. Yeah, they engage different tracks, I suppose, because just to keep them separated, safe and outside as well. But I would say, even though it's made for two live audience members, for the first time ever, we are conceiving and making of a piece of work that will be live streamed. So it will be free to people to engage with from wherever they are in the world. And details of that streaming and when it will happen will go on to Dublin Theatre Festival website in the next few days. So for us, it's a very new way of thinking about making work and responding to work. And indeed, how do we engage with audiences who might be coming back to us in a digital form? You know, so this is a very different proposition for us to make, but very exciting. And one in which we, you know, I was listening to Marina and to Emma there as well. You know, the challenge of live theatre is brilliant now, but also the absolute privilege that we have to be able to engage with audiences in the now is something that is profoundly special to us and really isn't lost on us in this time, you know.
You have a play within the Theatre for One experience as well, don't you?
I do indeed. It's called Bait. It's been performed by Una Kavanagh. Yeah, it's... I haven't really connected with them at all. Kind of did the play last year, handed it over, and had a little bit of conversation at the start of the festival time. And then I know they're in rehearsal. It's very exciting. They sent me some emails today. But I feel very removed from it in loads of ways. And I could look forward to going again as an audience. I saw them in Cork and was completely blown away by the sheer exhilaration of what they meant and the kind of the intimacy and the immersive experience of engaging with those actors was extraordinary.
Well, what is the basic premise, though, of the Theatre for One piece that you have?
Yeah, Bait is about a real-life woman. I suppose all of the people that I've written about for Dublin Theatre Festival are based on real people and people that we know. But Bait was based on a woman that I met a number of years ago who was talking about coming out of having lived in a domestic violence situation And actually, it was about the reframing of her life in the aftermath of surviving it, in which she discovered that there was a whole new landscape to navigate from where she was living, because she became known as that woman, and her whole immediate environs started to treat her quite differently. And it really is about how, and she engaged with her local community, and how some of them mistreated that trust that she offered from a really vulnerable vantage point. Until one morning she woke up, and the lady was telling us that she woke up with a footprint on her back, naked at the bottom of her stairs, and didn't realise how she'd gotten it. And it was just her re-understanding of who she was and what she was and where she was and why she was in that moment of time.
Yeah, well, I can only imagine the intensity of that experience then in the one-on-one aspect we get in the Theatre for One. That is the other project that we were speaking about with Marina Carr and Emmett Kerwin, as you said earlier on. But just to come back briefly then to the current project, or the other project that is part of the Dublin Theatre for Party Festival, The Party to End All Parties, is this idea of looking back forward and being there in the present, is that kind of at the heart of what you really want to do with the piece, Louise?
I think a lot of ways it's in the heart of all that we do with Anoushan, to be honest with you, because we're often looking at time through a lens of now, then, now, and looking at historical moments through that lens. I suppose what we're asking audiences to do at this show with us is to conceive of time and to reclaim it. And it becomes that reclamation of time becomes very vital to the characters that you're engaging with. And when you meet them, you'll know why. But I think in that moment of time, it's there for us to think about what we might want to do with that 25 minutes. You know, do you go back? Do you sort out something? Do you make a call that you wish you'd made a call years ago? What do you do with that? Yeah. And in that invitation, and in that brokering of that invitation, I think, and that communion with our performers in that space of now, time becomes elastic, and it becomes then, and it becomes now, and it becomes again in the future, and it becomes a merge of time and place. But what is vital is that we, as audiences, are standing on that bridge in the now. And Dublin is playing itself around us, and it feels like the most important time ever to ask questions of who we are and why we are and where we are in this present city, and what is our relationship to it now as we're in this time, but also what we would hope for it in future nights.
Great. Well, listen, great to speak to you as always. That said, Louise Lowe of Avana Theatre Company, and the piece that she's been talking about there, The Party to End All Parties, opens on September the 24th, runs through until the 11th of October, throughout the day, Monday to Saturday. October the 8th is the special streamed performance, and you can get full details of all of that on dublintheatrefestival.ie. Pan Pan Theatre's new project, What is the Word, is at the IFI as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival on the 6th and 7th of October. This is an audio and cinematic experience presenting a curated collection of Samuel Beckett poems. Here's Ned Dennehy reading a poem called The Downs.
One dead of night, in the dead still, he looked up from his book. From that dark, to pour on other dark, till afar taper faint the eyes in the dead still. Till afar his book, as by a hand not his, a hand on his, faintly closed, for good or ill, for good and ill.
Ned Dennehy there with The Downs by Samuel Beckett, and that's part of Pan Pan's Theatre's What is the Word, which is at the IFI, the Irish Film Institute, as part of the Dublin Theatre Festival on the 6th and 7th of October, dublintheatrefestival.ie for full details. Embargo is a new play by writer Deirdre Kinahan. It's the story of three people caught up in the violent winds of change in Dublin in 1920. During the War of Independence, dockers and railway men refused to transport any armed troops or to handle any weapons arriving from Britain. And on the centenary of this act of civil resistance, Fishamble will stage a site-responsive production in association with Éireann Road Éireann and Dublin Port Company. And that, again, as everything we've been speaking about this evening, is part of the Dublin Theatre Festival. And Deirdre Kinahan joins me now on the line to tell me more. Very particular moment in time, this, in the War of Independence. What attracted you to it, Deirdre?
I suppose when we think about the War of Independence, we've always been told about the Sean Tracys and the Dan Breens and the men with guns, you know, and the ambushes and the bushes, from the bushes and the hills. But that was only one of the things that actually brought the British to the table in 1921. A big part of the War of Independence was civil disobedience, and I suppose that was something that always kind of interested me and fascinated me, the fact that ordinary people were involved in this struggle for freedom. And when Jim Cullerton approached me from Fishamble and spoke to me about the embargo and the fact that Dublin Port and Irish Rail wanted to commemorate it, I knew something about it. There was a little flicker in the back of my mind. But I didn't know the whole story. And we realised that very few people know the story. And then I began to think a lot about the labour movement and how important the labour movement was and that push for socialism was at that time and how that played a big role in it. And the fact that it's kind of been hidden away and not talked about. And I thought, well, when you think about the very conservative Catholic state that emerged from our revolution, it's not surprising that you know, kind of very grassroots, popular, you know, dangerous civil militancy was part of the burgeoning of the New Ireland.
Yeah, and the civil resistance that we're talking here, the specifics of, as you say, dockers and, or as we've said already, dockers and rail workers
and the drivers refusing
to be part of any kind of transportation of either soldiers or weaponry connected with the British Army. There's kind of echoes of 1913 and the lockout here as well, isn't there?
Absolutely. And that's, yeah, I found myself going there kind of straight away. So when I wanted to look at an incident like this, I thought, how do I do it? How do I bring an audience in? And the best way to do it is to create a scenario, a dilemma. And I wanted to look at a character who supported the embargo, but found himself in a place where he might have to break it. And I wanted the characters to kind of represent the extraordinary conflicts of events that were whirling around Dublin and around the world at that time. It was such a revolutionary time. There was such upheaval. There was shootings. There was raids. You know, there was curfews. And there were huge strikes.
Yeah.
And so one, my character, the characters at the centre of it, one in particular, Jane, is kind of a tired revolutionary. She was involved in the 1913 lockout. She was involved in 1916. You know, she's been kind of fighting for a better life for nigh on 10 years. But she finds herself in 1920, a widow with four children and no future. And she commits an act that's a violent act, and she has to run from it. And she runs into the cab of a train in Connolly Station. And there's a driver sitting there ready to drive the train to Belfast. And she says, "You've got to get me out of here. You've got to get me to Belfast." And the two of them kind of connect. And his story is, he's a Republican. He believes in freedom. He's come home from the First World War. He's been traumatized by the violence that he's seen there. So while he supports the move for independence, he doesn't necessarily support the IRA, you know, or how they're going about it. And he agrees to drive her to Belfast. But then a third character comes in, and he's a young revolutionary Republican, you know, gun on the shoulder, you know, straight out of the kind of radicalization period. And he says, "Lads, this train isn't going to Belfast because the soldiers on it. So you've got this kind of dilemma where three people are caught up in this momentous moment, but their own lives are being tossed about as a result of it.
And the specifics of the three characters, Gracie being the driver of the train, and the man, as you say, who has fought in the war and who would have Republican sympathies for sure and would be in favour of the embargo, but finds himself in this dilemma with the young woman, Jane. And then Jack is the young character, the young IRA man, who's going nowhere. He's going to obey the embargo absolutely and totally to the letter of the law. And that provides the dramatic dilemma here. How imagined are these, or how much did some of these stories come from research, Deirdre?
Yeah, I suppose that there's always, they are imaginary characters, but certainly when I was writing Jane, I was thinking very much of Rosie Hackett and Helena Maloney and all those extraordinary women who set up the first Women's Workers Union and the kind of struggles they had and the lives they had. And when I was thinking of Jack, I was very influenced by Dan Breen. I read his biography, Bobby Monteith's biography. I've been dancing with these ghosts a long time. I wrote Wild Sky, which was in commemoration of 1916. I've been commissioned to write a Civil War play as well. And just, I find it such an extraordinary kind of period. Do you know? It was so volcanic. Yeah. It was and it's where we've all come from. And then the character of Gracie is a beautiful character that stalked me for a number of years, that originally came out of actually some work I was doing around Roger Casement. And he's a gay man who is attracted to kind of cross-dressing because of the beautiful feminine softness that he associates with the fabrics that allow him escape from the trauma of the trenches in World War One. And when he comes back to Ireland, having escaped one war, he finds himself tossed into the midst of another war. But he's a very different kind of a person, and he's a gay man. And I'm kind of asking questions about, you know, with a woman like Jane, with a man like Gracie, how hospitable was the new Ireland, the new republic them. That Jack is so ardently fighting for, going to be to them?
I want to briefly get an aspect of the site here. It'll be performed in the waiting room at Connolly Station, the pump house at the Dublin Port Company. How important is that aspect of the tale in the telling?
Really important, Sean, because it was conceived, you know, always to be played in those two site-specific venues. Like, the action of the play takes place in a train, Dublin to Belfast, in Amien Street Station, as it was at the time, now Connolly. And we're actually just off the platform for the Dublin to Belfast train. And then the murderous event at the centre of the story actually took place in the pump house. Mm. So those two places really influenced, you know, my approach to it. And I think they will really resonate for an audience, you know, when they find themselves actually sitting there and listening to the trains hooting by.
Yeah, it'll bring them into the reality of the story that's been told. Deirdre Kinahan, thanks for speaking to us this evening, Deirdre. And Deirdre's play Embargo, part of the Dublin Theatre Festival, runs from the 2nd, this play runs from the 2nd to the 4th of October at the Enterprise Waiting Room in Connolly Station on 9th to the 11th of October at the Pump House in Dublin Port. Full details there on DublinTheatreFestival.ie, where you'll find out full details of everything we've been speaking about this evening. The Theatre Festival itself running from Thursday of next week through until October the 11th. A big thanks to Willie White and all at the Dublin Theatre Festival for their help in putting together our guests and the ideas around this evening's programme. But that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Sound supervision this evening was Damien Chanel. And tonight's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy.